If season 5 of our Jazz Backstory podcast was a big band arrangement, we'd be at the point in the chart where we've had the solos and the shout chorus, and we're returning to the head and coda. Welcome to episode 38, titled, "You're a Funny Guy." I do my best to avoid generalizations about music and its players. But in the 30 years that I've been conducting video interviews for the Phileas Jazz Archive and observing musicians in groups, I can safely say that jazz and humor comprise a perfect duet. Jazz musicians laugh a lot. This is especially true for the generation of jazz cats who learned their trade on the road, from mentors, on stage, pre-jazz academia. Humor helped them deal with the road travails, racial injustices, quirky band leaders, and the uncertainty of the career itself. During our June 2023 interview, saxophonist Lou Marini offered insight and an anecdote relevant to our topic. The cast of characters include band leaders Thad Jones and Mel Lewis, and legendary drummer Elvin Jones.
You know, that was one thing about, like, the Ken Burns documentary. It was absolutely devoid of humor. And when I think of my life as a musician, and, you know, I am a jazz musician, but I've played so many different things that I don't know if everybody considers me a jazz musician. But I've certainly, you know, like, you can't remember the music with Thad and Mel that night when Elvin came in to the dressing room and said he wanted to sit in, and Mel said no. And Thad is standing between him, and the two of them start arguing, and Elvin can't believe that Mel won't let him sit in, and they get hotter and hotter, and Thad is looking at him. It looked like a tennis match. And finally, Elvin says, "Why won't you let me sit in?" And Mel says, "Because the last time you sat in, you cracked my favorite cymbal. You're not sitting in." You know, you remember that. You remember the funny stuff that happened. And, you know, one thing I think about with musicians is we are laughing all the time. We are cracking. When I think about my life as a musician, you know, I think of the delight that I've had in knowing all these maniacs, And I think that one thing that happens is that when you spend so much time by yourself practicing, you sharpen your personality. I think that something happens that you become more singular. And that in your own, whatever your particular manner is, you know. You get these personalities that are so unique, you know. I don't know. I'm dreaming or delusional, but I really think that, you know.
Singular personalities. Maybe that explains it. On occasion, I am asked, "What are these jazz people like?" No generalizations here. It's easier to tell you what they're not like. Rarely boring. To function in the jazz world, a robust sense of humor became an unwritten requirement, along with skill, determination, passion, and spontaneity. A term often used to describe jazz improvisation is playing in the moment. Occasionally, musicians find the need to respond to a moment when they're not even close to a bandstand. Our topic for this episode demands a replay from episode 13, Life on the Road. The Lucky Millinder Band regularly toured the southern U.S. during the late 1940s. It was a mixed band, and trouble was a constant companion. Trumpeter Joe Wilder described a typical encounter.
You had told me about an incident with one of the bands you were with in the South, I think it was South Carolina.
Lucky Millinder.
Yes, yeah. And it was the first time you'd been down there with an
integrated band. Yeah, we were in South Carolina, and Lucky Millinder, Lucky was a very nice fellow. He was not a musician, but he had a lot of natural talent for selecting the right kinds of tunes and tempos and things of that nature. But we had, I think, six of the members of the band were white. And when we arrived early in South Carolina at this hall where we were going to play, and suddenly up drove the sheriff with his deputy in the police car, and he said, "Who's in charge here?" And so Lucky said, "I am." He said, "Well, I'm just here to tell you there's not going to be any mixed bands playing down here in Charleston." And Lucky looked at this guy. Lucky, another reason I think they call him Lucky, he would take a chance on anything. He looked this guy dead in the eye and said, "This is not a mixed band." And some of the guys are blonde with blue eyes and all this. There's no way in the world anybody would have mistaken any of these guys for being black, you know. And so he went to each guy. I think if he had said, are you black? He might have gotten a different answer, but he went to each of these guys and asked him, said, "Are you colored?" And each of the guys, going along with what Lucky had said, so would say yes, you know, and he sort of shake his head. And he got finally the last of the guys he asked was Porky Cohen, who was our first trombone player. And he had a slight lisp. And when he asked him, now Porky is responding more emphatically than the other guys, and he said, "Why, certainly," with this lisp. And at this point, we had all been standing there chewing on our tongues and everything, trying not to break up because it was so ludicrous. And when he did this, you could almost feel the ground tremble with the guys laughing, trying not to let the sheriff see them. But anyway, he turned to the deputy. He said, "Well, I guess if they all say they're colored, there ain't nothing we can do about it, is it, Jeff?" And so he said, "No, Sheriff," and they got in the car and they drove off, and we played that dance that night.
That's amazing.
It was very funny. And it might, as I mentioned to you, it might have been the first time that an integrated band played there. Mm-hmm. It's very possible that that was the first time.
Based on the historical record, this incident could have ended in a very different fashion. I can imagine the coverage in the Charleston Post and Courier. Band leader and band spend the night in the Huskow after public disturbance. Lucky Millinder may have had his share of good luck, but he also knew how to operate in the moment, as did his band members. Humor as self-preservation. Make a note to yourself. Check out Life on the Road, episodes 12 and 13. The stories are all as rich as this one. A select group developed their humor so well that their jazz became an accompaniment to stand-up routines. Comic jazz man Pete Barbuti spoke about the connection during our 2022 session. When you discovered at some point, I'm not sure if it would have been the accordion or the trumpet, but that you could play music that wasn't specifically written on a piece of paper, did that feeling eventually help your comedy routines?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because comedy, I just talked to somebody that is a great entertainer. He's living back in the New England states now. We talked about it a little bit. He said, "You came into my dressing room, we're working together, and you gave me this big lecture about jazz and comedy being the same thing." He says, "I still remember it. It was a long time ago." But yeah, I was a crusader for that because it's the same thing. When you're playing jazz, you're still, it's obligatory that you stick to the same chord structure, and you can't add a beat whenever you want to. You know, the specific number of beats. And what you do is within this framework, you take the liberties and you change the melody, but you're still obligated to stay within the same number of bars and whatever it is, the same chord structure. Comedy is the same thing. There has to be a believability. You know, the infamous pig joke that I did on the Tonight Show, it's you start off with something that's really real and it's true. And you went to this guy's farm and he had the pig and you go through this whole thing, but there has to be a reality to it. You can't say there was this elephant flying over, you know, I mean, right away the people know there's nothing to that. So you have a reality to it and then you ad lib it, you know, you change the ending or change the...
Yes, indeed. Melody followed by improvisation. I'm guessing there are a few of you out there thinking, what's the infamous pig joke? My exhaustive internet search did not yield a film of Pete Barbuti telling the pig joke, but I do have a memory of watching him deliver it on The Tonight Show. I believe this is the gist of the pig joke. One day a man drove by a farm and saw a three-legged pig. The man went up to the farmer and said, "Excuse me, but why does that pig only have three legs?" "Well," said the farmer, "that pig is very special. One time my wife was cooking something, she stepped out of the kitchen and it caught on fire. No one in the house knew about it but the pig. He saved me, my wife, and my two kids." "That's amazing," said the man. "But why does the pig only have three legs?" "Well, there was that time the pig saw a big storm coming and we didn't. Pig ran into the house, dragged us out to the storm cellar. If it weren't for that pig, we'd all be dead." "But still, that doesn't explain why the pig only has three legs." "Well, I remember the time my youngest son was stuck up a tree, but he was too far away to hear his cries for help. The pig ran to me and led me to where he was." "Well, that's a miracle. But how come the pig only has three legs?" the man said, quite annoyed at this point. "Well," said the farmer, "with a pig that special, you have to eat him real slow." Yeah, I know. Don't quit my day gig. I laughed most of the way through the interview with Mr. Barbuti. He had no lack of "let me tell you about this gig" stories. Here's one about a casino date where Pete was thrown in with a bunch of impersonators.
So I went down there and I got there and the band was a rock band, like a trio, and they had no idea what I was doing, you know. So rather than go through a whole thing and lose my cool or anything, I just said, "Look, when I go like this or I say this, just play a B flat chord or something, and no use, you know, fighting it." And so that's good enough, because most of it I did mostly, you know, instead of the music, I did most of the straight stand up. And I found the opening act was an Elvis impersonator. And then there was a girl who did an impersonation of Stevie Nicks, who's a rock and roll singer. And then the next act was a group of four or five guys who did the Temptations. They, you know, sang all their songs and so forth. And then I went on, and just before they were there, I'd let them close the show. And then they said, "On the weekends, we go out and stand in the casino behind the theater rope, and the people come by, and we thank them for coming in and shake their hand." I said, "Fine." So I went out there, and the people were coming by, and they were saying to me, "You look just like them." And there was no response. There was no appropriate response. I mean, what am I going to say? I am him, or thank you very much.
Why? Thank you. My impersonations must have been a success.
Yeah, it was very strange. I've never had that happen before or since.
It's funny you say that about, you know, warm-up acts. I played in a rock and roll band for years, and one time we showed up in Rochester, and we were warming up for a turtle race.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, my career is really on the upswing here.
Well, that's a spinoff of the old joke about the guy, the band who works New Year's Eve, and the club owner says, "You guys are great. I'd like to have you again for New Year's Eve." And the drummer says, "Oh, that's great. Can I leave my drums here?"
The funniest guy seems to be on the West Coast. Pete Barbuti was matched wit for wit by trumpeter Jack Sheldon and sax man Dave Pell. Jack's voice will sound familiar. Besides being a first-class trumpet player, Jack was the Schoolhouse Rock Conjunction Junction character. His escapades with comedian Lenny Bruce made for some wild and crazy guy moments.
But Lenny Bruce and I did this show called Stars or something. It was a guy had a show that he had a car dealership on Wilshire and Western. and it was Stairway to the Stars or Rocket to Stardom. Rocket to Stardom, right. I think that was it, yeah. So we went on, and at this time, there was another guy, Jay Caruso, who sold cars, who had been indicted for cheating everybody or doing something terrible. So Lenny and I went on, and he was starting to sing, Without a Song, but he couldn't get the right key, you know, and he was going, without a song, and I was playing stuff in the background, and then he finally says, Caruso is innocent, and they chased us out of this place. We ran, and we went back to Pete Jolly's house, who you just interviewed, right? Yeah, Pete Jolly, we went to his house. Stan Levy and Richie Kamuka were there.
Lenny Bruce must have been something to hang out with if off stage he was anything like on stage.
Yeah, well, he was a lot of fun. We did have fun working with him. We worked Joe Maney and myself and Kenny Drew and Philly Joe Jones and Leroy Vinegar. We opened this club, a burlesque club called Duffy's. And we worked there with Lenny, and Lenny's wife, Honey, she sang at the time. She had stripped before, but she didn't want to strip anymore, or Lenny didn't want her to. And so we worked there, and we opened the place up, and we about 2 o'clock in the morning, everybody would be swinging. They closed the club, so one time I brought everybody home to my house. Well, this night, Yvonne DiCarlo's mother had come in there with a gigolo. With a guy with a pinstripe suit and a little mustache, black and white shoes, you know, slick hair. Looked a lot like you, in fact. And she got up on the stage, and they were fixing the stage at the time. It had a hole in it. And she fell in this hole, and just her legs were sticking up. So I took everybody to my house, and I was married at the time. My wife woke up and kicked everybody out. And they were fighting. She was fighting with a gigolo out on the lawn, and the cops came. And they got arrested, and they were written up in Confidential magazine, which was one of the first magazines back then. Remember, Robert Mitchum was in it with Lila Leeds and getting busted. Went to the road camp out in Malibu.
You've led a pretty boring life, haven't you?
No, I've had a great life. I really have had a great life.
I'll admit to a bit of confusion when Lenny Bruce yelled, Caruso is innocent. I assumed he was somehow referring to the early 20th century opera star Enrico Caruso. This time the internet yielded this bizarre story, humorous now, probably not then. Printed in the New York Times, November 16th, 1906. Signor Enrico Caruso, tenor, was charged with an indecent act allegedly committed in the Monkey House of New York Central Park Zoo. The police accused him of pinching the buttocks of a married woman. Caruso claimed a monkey did the bottom pinching. He was later found guilty and fined $10, although evidence suggested that he may have been entrapped by the victim and the arresting officer. New York's opera-going high society was outraged by the incident, which received extensive coverage, but it was soon forgotten, and Caruso's popularity was unaffected. Now, what does that have to do with jazz? Nothing. Except, I'm sure Enrico would have preferred to be a jazz singer. Too bad for him it hadn't been invented yet. We'll complete our West Coast comic trio with an anecdote from Dave Pell. You may recall hearing from Dave Pell back in the episode 7, where he admitted to purposely knocking over the saxophone of bandleader Les Brown so he wouldn't have to suffer through his solos. At one point in his career, Dave led a band with a slick style for commercial recordings and social events. Who enters the picture? Jack Sheldon, of course.
Well, it's important to try to establish a sound is like Shearing did. Yeah. You know, he had
same thing, the Block Hands, right, playing with guitar underneath.
Yeah.
And it was all that kind of sound, and it was a very commercial sound, because we could do albums of Rodgers and Hart and Berlin and Jimmy Van Heusen and all those things that you're doing now. We did them 45 years ago, which was, they said, oh, pal, you're so commercial. I said, yeah, but I'm home every night. I'm not on the road. I work every weekend. I work college dates. We do a jazz concert, but we also do a dance.
Mm-hmm.
We behave. You know, when Jack Sheldon came on the band, and I'm trying to behave, and he's such an unbridled character, and I'm saying, Jack, please, melody. And he said, what is this? I want to play jazz. What is this? No, Jack, we're playing a prom. Everybody's dressed out there. They're going to remember this all their lives, and here you are. And he got up one time and started playing a solo. He said, key of F. And, you know, everybody plays medleys. Med Florey would get up and sing. Ray Sims would play and sing. And Jack calls out a tune, three flats. And the piano player modulates into three flats. And Jack sits there and plays bup, 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 bup. And he does a whole chorus of just bup, bup. And afterwards we said, oh, what tune was that, Jack? He says, Jumping at the Woodside, third trumpet part. And we died, you know that. And here you are in a lovely prom and everybody's so dressed up and everything. Here's the great jazz player playing bup, bup.
The third trumpet part. Some of the most intricate and celebrated jazz arrangements had inner parts that were far from interesting. The saxes could be playing finger-busting lines. The first trumpet is wailing. The rhythm section swinging like crazy. Meanwhile, the third trumpet and fourth trombone are playing bup, 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 bup. Pete Barbeauty actually fashioned a comic routine about it that plays especially well with brass players. Any interviewer likes to feel that they have some measure of control during a recorded conversation. Drummer Jake Hanna could be the fourth member of the West Coast Jazz Comic Combo. I met with him at the Jerome Jazz Party in Aspen, Colorado, on October 11, 1997. Within the first 30 seconds, I abandoned all hope of having any influence on where this interview was going to go.
We're in Aspen, Colorado, filming for the Hamilton College Jazz Archive, and I've been waiting for this for quite a while now. We're filming with Jake Hanna, one of the great jazz drummers and conversationalists.
Conversationalists, yes. I love your name, Monk. I'm going to start using that name, Monk Rowe. I've been using Sneed Hearn for years, but Monk Rowe, that's a hell of a name. I never heard a name like that.
It works.
Lonnie's Monk was far out, but Monk Rowe is...
I'll be That's expecting some checks in the mail, though, if you
oh,
start
good.
To do that.
Oh, good. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, good. I'll send you back yours and bounce to me if I bounce back to you.
Yeah. Oh, my.
Sound like a basketball.
I'm going to read something here.
All right.
Okay, that you told to a very famous lady. You had three childhood heroes. Brace Beamer,
the Lone Ranger. Ross Tompkins knows him.
Okay. Yeah. Benny Goodman.
B.G., yeah.
And Ted Williams.
Big Ted, yeah.
Now, what happened to Brace?
Brace passed away. I think he moved to Florida. Yeah, he moved to Florida because Ross Tompkins' father knew him in Detroit. And I think he died. I think he took over that Lone Ranger show.
We should tell our viewers who he was in case...
Well, he played the part of the Lone Ranger. He actually produced the show originally, I think. Somebody else played the Lone Ranger. They all started leaving and doing something, going to some other... So he just took over the role, plus the show, you know.
Yeah,
a very popular guy, I guess. You know, part of the Lone Ranger played by your announcer, Brace Beamer. So it's, I don't know how they did it. Maybe two guys did the whole show. Who knows?
Yeah. You know. And of course, Ted Williams.
Ted, the best. King of Swing. A real king of swing. I tell you, he was really something. Yeah, I liked him because he was like a salmon, you know, like Buddy Rich. He swam upstream. Everything was coming against him, and the press was 100% against him. Not the press, but guy named Parker, Colonel Dave Parker, a real bad nipple.
Uh-huh.
And Ted just fought them all and
no
won.
No kidding.
And won, beat them all down, yeah. Just single-handed, you know, just fantastic. They pulled a shift on him, you know, it's still the most ferocious shift ever pulled in any ball player. They had one for Stanley Musial, too, was a hell of a hitter, too. But they all did, everybody's over this planet. All the fans, everybody get over one side of the field. The dogs, the cats, the guys that sold the hot dogs, they all get over one side. Mandela, Tootsie Mandela's father was a hot dog salesman out there. He'd get over and hold on the right side. And he hit against him. It's wrong.
Uh-huh.
Who the hell wants to see him hit over there, you know,
yeah,
the left field? But he did, one time they were playing Cleveland and they all pulled over. And he popped one over the left field wall, which is a very short fence anyway. Uh-huh. He said, he's walking, see, I can do that anytime I want. They said, yeah, we know that, you know.
Well, at least we learned about the Ted Williams outfield shift. We did eventually talk about Jazz and his career, but I recall being exhausted after that hour, struggling to match wits with Mr. Hanna. Jake's career went back far enough for him to be aware of the relationship between drummers and comedy. During the vaudeville era, it was expected that the drummer in the orchestra pit would catch moments in the onstage routines by accentuating the jokes, pratfalls, and physical delivery of the comedian. This short anecdote about Jake from trombonist Bill Watrous can be placed in the painfully funny category.
There must have been some funny moments with Jake Hanna.
Oh, Jake was hysterical.
Yeah.
He would say, so many drummers, so little time, you know.
Now, you told me about some guy who fell off a scaffold.
Oh, yeah, a guy came falling off the boom. He was a boom operator, and he lost his balance and fell down and bounced his all the way down, hitting things, and he finally caught himself in the leg, and Jake goes,
nice guy.
He caught him, yeah, he nailed him. You know, the guy broke his leg in three places, and Jake was bugged. He said, geez, and I caught him, too.
Back in episode 8, we used the term, a gig is a gig. In order to pay the bills, jazz musicians routinely played engagements where little or no jazz was involved. The most humorous anecdotes often came from those non-jazz jobs. And yes, they're funny now, usually not amusing when they occurred. I'll close this episode with a couple of mine. There was a period of years where rock guys and girls from the 60s would do summer nostalgia tours, playing their hits, sometimes just the one-hit wonder they had, for fans who used to own the 45 RPM records. When they arrived in town, the booking agent was supposed to have lined up a backup band. I frequently played these gigs, much to my delight, as I owned those 45s. Del Shannon of Runaway fame, you know, wah, 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 wonder, came to Utica, and when I got the call to play keyboards with him, I immediately started learning the classic solo, played originally on an early synthesizer called a Novatron. It's one of those perfect instrumental moments. I had it down. Could have played it with my eyes closed. During the brief pre-concert run-through, Del called Runaway, looked at me and said, Monk, you know that synth part in the middle? Sure thing, I replied. Well, play something else. I hate that damn solo. What? I was bummed. I wish I could say that I played it anyway, but I don't think I did, as Del kept me on for 3 more gigs around Central New York. We have a thriving casino in the area, and they frequently bring in oldies acts and veteran comedians. Joan Rivers is booked, wants a 9-piece band to play her on and off. She does not have one, nor any music for a band to play. I get the gig, book the players, compose an upbeat Tonight Show type walk-on, and we gather on stage 2 hours before the show. Ms. Rivers comes out and goes through the routine, first warning all the musicians not to help her when she asks for assistance in moving the huge potted plants situated stage right and left. She then explains to me that there's a warm-up comic, and she'll be in the wings introducing him. When When I say his name, you hit it. I got it. Showtime. Joan and the warm-up guy, his name was Tony something, are in the wings. She's enthusiastically greeting the audience, a full house. She's into it, gesticulating with every word. On stage, there's no monitors. What I'm hearing is, crap, I don't know what she's saying. Panic. Finally, she makes one over-the-top gesture, and I hear, I decide, that's it. Hit it, guys. The band nails the tune. Yeah, I'm conducting for Joan Rivers. The next thing I know, Joan Rivers marches out on stage, comes up to me and says into her mic, no, 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 that's not what you're supposed to do. My heart stopped as I cut off the band. Then I witnessed a real pro with the spontaneity that comedians share with jazz cats. She made it look like it was part of the act, calmly explaining to me, the band, and the audience how the second try was going to go. I'm trying to play into her shtick. Yes, Miss Rivers. Sure thing, Miss Rivers. Thank you, Miss Rivers. Take two went as originally planned, and I did take some solace in the fact that despite her begging and pleading for help moving the plants, no one in the band moved a muscle. The most successful thing we did that night was nothing. All musicians have their favorite stories. This was one of mine. But I assure you, I was not laughing on the way home. That's all, folks. Thanks go out to my team, Michael Coe, Leo Yu, Romy Bertel, Doug Higgins, and our orchestra in a nutshell. You can view the full video interviews with these jazz humorists on the Phileas Jazz Archive YouTube channel. Drop me a comment or suggestion at mrowe@hamilton.edu. I hope you tune into episodes 39 and 40. See you on the flip side.